This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And once again, it seems to be all about the Premier and his latest going on about that homeowner in Vaughan who shot a home invader.
As for the person that was defending his family, he was a legal gun owner, it was stored properly. Congratulations. Yeah, I'm glad you shot the guy. Teach us the rest of these robbers, and I encourage everyone out there that's a legal gun owner. Someone's going to come in and try to kill you and kill your family. Remember, it was just last week, Jamie, one guy got shot because he was trying to protect his kids. Well, you know, these guys, they need to be shot, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, as expected, that set off a wave of criticism, and it wasn't the first time DOFO was taking a swipe at our justice system. Earlier in the week, he was calling for the live streaming of bail hearings. That after the story of that convicted child murderer and rapist who got three unescorted passes into the community, even though he is still considered dangerous. And yes, I'm sure that part of the impetus for Ford was to distract us from some not so great things he's doing, like moving legislation soon to shield his records, his phone records, his cabinets from the public. But I think he is onto something, because I think that the public just doesn't feel safe. And they feel that the entire justice system is tilted towards criminals at the expense of victims and just regular citizens. And a big part of that is what seems to be a total lack of consequences for transgressions from the smallest to the largest. So, what do you think? The numbers to call, the text line, 866-744-740. You can also make a long-distance phone call on that, and the local phone line, 416-360-0740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, Toronto City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East, Brad Bradford, Toronto City Councillor for Ward 19, Beaches East York, and a mayoral candidate, and Karen Stintz, a former Toronto City Councillor. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Libby.
Hey, Libby.
Hey.
Hello, Libby.
Okay, John, we're gonna start with you because you are a former cop. So, what do you make of Doug Ford going on and saying, "Good for the guy who shot the home invader," and I think other people should do it. And is he onto something in terms of the way people feel?
Well, definitely, I would say he's on to something. I think he's very good at expressing about what other people are feeling. And the idea that someone could break into your house and be armed with handguns or other type of firearms, and somehow you could potentially be charged for shooting them, is beyond offensive to most people. I think that one of the, so he's very good at that, and people will applaud him. I think what will be an issue, or could be an issue, is the question is, what are you doing about it as the Premier, right? And that can be beefing up police. It could be really hammering home to the feds that they need to step up to the plate, whatever the case might be. So that's where I think the issue is. But I think the biggest issue is people don't feel that the police are up to the job of protecting them. I think that's what we need to tackle. People need to feel confidence in their police service that they can actually do the job and we don't have to resort to protecting ourselves.
Well, yes, but you just heard in Jeremy's news another issue with police. And when you challenge police, Brad, they say the politicians don't have our back. And that's one of my issues, is that every level, from the police to the municipal government to the provincial government to the federal government, they just point their fingers at another jurisdiction.
Yeah, there's always a lot of professional buck passing when it comes to the three levels of government. But at the end of the day, I don't think Torontonians or folks here in the province or the country really care about that. You know, John's right. People do not feel safe right now. I think the premier has tapped into that. And while it's perhaps a bit unusual to have a premier out saying, you know, good on you for shooting someone, that's a bit of a strange message coming from the top. I think that is where people are at right now. I had an opportunity to meet with somebody yesterday who was victim of a violent home invasion. He was beaten with hammers, blood all over the place. He had just finished a surgery to correct an issue with his arm as a result of that home invasion. His partner has now moved out of the city because she's uncomfortable being in their matrimonial home. And so when you think about scenarios that are truly terrifying, for me, it's the idea of somebody kicking the front door in and coming into my house when I'm there with my wife and my two young daughters. And I think, you know, there is a real sentiment that this stuff is out of hand right now. It feels like the law and the legislation protects the criminals instead of the people who are abiding by the rule of law. And, you know, this guy who was shot, you know, that was invading, this guy has 8 breaches of probation orders, including stealing a truck and doing a high-speed chase through Mississauga with an 8-year-old girl inside.
Exactly. So, eight. Like,
yeah.
Why is he? I mean, it is just so beyond the pale. But Karen, you know, the premier saying all that isn't going to make people feel any safer.
No, I think it actually has the opposite effect, to be honest. And that there's this notion that now you should protect yourself because the system isn't there to protect you. And I think that the subtext of that is actually quite damaging to communities, because if there's a belief in the general community that the systems that we put our faith in don't deserve our faith anymore, and that now I'm on my own to protect myself, that's when you start to have really strange behaviors around, you know, gated communities and hiring security. And we've already seen it that, you know, neighborhoods have put up cameras to monitor the comings and goings of people that are traversing through, and they've had, you know, they hire private security. And as for a community to become more and more insular because they lose faith with the institutions that are there to protect them, I think becomes a very damaging thing for us collectively.
Okay,
I would just add, if I can, Libby, I think Karen's absolutely right. The fact that so many neighborhoods and individuals who have the means to afford private security now are investing in that because they feel they have to is emblematic of a failure of local government. The fact that folks feel like they have to take it into their own hands to hire a private security company to sit 24/7 in their driveway or patrol the neighborhood, which is a huge expense for people, but those that can afford it are doing it. That to me is an example of government failing the citizens of the basic security and safety of our persons. That's job number one. And, you know, all three levels of government share in the blame, the fact that this isn't being taken care of right now.
I know people who are doing that, and I was going to bring it up because there's often been a line, and we get criticized for it, where certain bad things happen in certain areas and not in other areas. And I've said before, I live in Midtown Toronto. I'm on my residents' association. We are members of a group of residents' associations. And at our meeting last night, we got a report from our chair about the latest FONTRA meeting of the Residents Association. And yeah, it's Midtown Toronto. People are well off, but people really do not feel safe. And last week we had one incident at Glencairn and Avenue Road. Most of this stuff happens up north. And frankly, I even feel strange bringing this up with the panel because I don't want to give anybody any ideas. But this is really widespread. People are scared. And John, I mean, what do people do aside from, if they have the money, hiring private security?
Well, I think the problem is everyone feels helpless, right? Because they don't know what to do. And I was recounting a story to you, Libby, how I was walking my dogs at 4:30 in the afternoon across the street from my house. It goes into the valley and there's a path that's not meant for cars, just pedestrians. And I turn the corner and there's a Honda Accord with the doors and the trunk open and a couple look like kids, being like 15 to 17 year olds. They had hoodies on, mulling about. And as I got closer, I smelt gasoline. And next thing you know, one pulls something out of his pocket, lit it, threw it in the trunk, and the trunk blew up. And obviously this was a stolen car and there's probably a heck of a lot more going on. And I call police and you know, life goes on, but people do, it's that feeling of helplessness, I think, as well, that is so frustrating and why people won't take the TTC. They'll drive their car more because they don't feel that anyone has their back. And, you know, I would say to whether it's the premier, the prime minister, the mayor, whatever the case it would be, is that they all need to sit down and come up with an actual plan. Like, what can the city do to change things for which they're responsible? What can the province do, and what can the federal government do? Forget the finger pointing. Come up with a 20-point plan or whatever it is. Commit to it, and I think that's where you will get meaningful change, not just John Burnside sitting on the radio complaining about it.
Okay, I'm going to take a couple of calls, and then Brad, since you are running, let's see what you would do about it. Let me find my cursor here. Let's go to Ron in Port Perry. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you doing? I just don't think we're scaring the criminals enough. I think we should build a facility. And if you're caught carrying a gun, illegal, or a ridiculous knife or something, no lawyers, no court time, we'll pick a number, 3 months in jail, 6 months in jail. I couldn't care if they stayed in jail myself. But, you know, it's just like painting the statues. For some reason, we weren't, I'm 75, we're not perfect when we were kids, but you didn't deface property. You know, you'd done stupid things, but not what, I just don't think the criminals are scared enough, and they can spend 3 and 4 years ripping around in courts, and nothing ever happens. And like that fellow that's walking the street today, we fed him for 40 years. You know, something's strong's got to happen to these bad people.
Okay, you know? Ron. Yeah, I hear you. I think the premier heard you. I mean, this is how people are feeling. Let's go to John in Toronto. Hi, John.
Good day, madam. I tend to agree with what the last guy said, but the thing of the system is, you know, they use underage kids. They don't go to adult court. They're out scot-free. And if somebody breaks into your house and you defend your family, you end up getting charged, which is, I think, ludicrous. I agree with Robert Ford to a certain extent. I don't want to shoot anybody. But to make a long story short, the guy that got shot the other day, his father is a good friend of mine. He's an ex-Army veteran. And he told me the same thing. If somebody broke into my house, I would have done the same thing, even though that was my own son.
Wow.
You know, so the law has to change.
Wow. Okay. I want to get back to Brad and John's comment, like there has to be a plan. And just yesterday, with great fanfare, the mayor and the police chief opened this safety hub in Lawrence Heights where bad things happened a year ago. But that's not a plan. That doesn't stop anything. So, Brad, what would you do if elected?
There's a lot of different things that we can do. And I guess the positive news here is that we can make it a lot better. You know, for starters, I will be on the police board. And why that's important is politicians always hide behind the sentence of, well, we don't direct the police. Well, the chief of police responds to the direction of the police board. And we need to have smart, thoughtful folks like Councillor John Burnside on the police board But you also need to have the mayor. It is the largest line item in our budget. So from a financial responsibility perspective, you should be there, you should be engaged. And it's also job number one of every government is to keep our citizens safe. Mayor Chow has engaged in what I would characterize as mayoral malpractice by not participating. She's delegated that authority away. And I think it shows it's not a priority for her. And it also shows on the TTC. It shows with the violent home invasions. It shows across a number of different files. And the fact that you hear time and time again from people that they don't feel safe in the city anymore. And it's especially acute on transit. So you have to be engaged in the problem and roll up your sleeves and committed to it. The other piece is the caller just identified. There's a lot of reform that's needed at other levels of government. You take this guy who was the criminal breaking into the house and, you know, he's got 8 breach of probation orders. He's stolen vehicles. He kidnapped the kid, allegedly. And, you know, he's out on bail. And so you need to use your bully pulpit as the mayor of the largest city in the country to go and push and advocate to the province and to the federal government and continue to make this an issue week in and week out. And I haven't heard a peep from Mayor Chow on any of these files as it relates to public safety and engagement with other levels of government. We all have to work together. I can't change the legislation with respect to the Youth Criminal Justice Act, but I can tell you when I was a 17-year-old, I knew that shooting somebody was wrong. And, you know, the way organized crime is weaponizing these primarily young men and using them to do this dirty work, there has to be consequences for that. So you got to use the platform that you have. Mayor Chow has not been doing it. We haven't seen the federal government moving fast enough on some of the changes that they campaigned on. But I would be there to support them in that effort. I would be there to advocate. And then we'll have a bunch of specific policy remedies that we can stand up here in the city of Toronto as well. But it starts with leadership and having some accountability and inserting yourself as someone who's going to deliver solutions. And Mayor Chow, to my mind, has just deflected and deferred and delegated to other people. And it's not working.
Karen, so what do you think should be done? Is having a mayor who's sitting on the police board going to do it? Again, the stuff they do to me is very performative.
Well, I certainly think Brad has a point in aligning accountability. Because I'll say as a citizen, and I've been out of it for, you know, I've been out of politics for some time, and I realize that I am an arm's length away from the decision makers or more yet. But as a citizen, it feels like there's no one that's accountable. And that, you know, the courts aren't accountable, the premier's not accountable, the mayor's not accountable, the police chief isn't accountable, the federal government isn't accountable, the parole board isn't accountable. And at a minimum, if you align the accountability between the mayor and the board of the chair and the chief of police, then at least you have alignment and you have accountability. So when things go sideways and, you know, organized crime is morphing into new directions and new threats into our city, at least we can tackle it politically and systemically. And I also think we need to stop being afraid of the courts. And we need to start doing things. And if we get challenged, we get challenged and we defend ourselves. And we have to go back and say, okay, fine, if we can't do this, what can we do? Because what we have now is not acceptable. Not acceptable in public opinion, not acceptable for public safety. And our Charter of Rights and Freedoms was never, ever, ever designed to split people apart into factions that now need to defend themselves against each other. That was not the intention of our Charter of Rights. So we find ourselves in a situation where everybody's rights are being protected and no one feels safe. And that is not where we were intended to be. So we need to actually, you know, put on our big boy pants and big girl pants and say, we have a job to do and it can't be hiding behind decisions. Well, it has to be out in front of them.
That's an interesting way of putting it. And John, I mean, taking on the courts, Doug Ford was doing that just yesterday, saying the judge in the Omar Zamir thing, and I don't want to go there particularly, should apologize. So there is this, seems to be this real divide from between the courts and people.
Well, yeah, and I think that was probably not one of his finest moments. But yeah, sure, there is a divide, but by the same token, let's just take bail. They say that the bail provisions aren't strong enough. Fair, but judges for 2, 3, 4 years have been complaining about the overcrowding in jails, and until that's addressed, they're going to let people out who they wouldn't normally let out on bail. So, you know, that's back to Brad's point about finger pointing. That's something the province can do to actually affect a change, and they'll get some buy-in from the judges, and I think that's one of the things that would actually improve the situation. So I think that by every level of government by blaming the other really is trying to allow themselves to do nothing. And so blame the courts all you like, but the Charter of Rights was federal legislation. So we can look at that. The Young Offenders Act, and I think Brad was talking about that, rightfully so, about using 15, 16, 14-year-olds, whatever, 17-year-olds. That's federal legislation. So you can blame the judges all you like. And yes, there are some judges who are absolutely horrible. But do what you need to do as a legislator, and I'm talking about the federal government, to change some of these things. As the province, make sure you have adequate jails so that now judges can't use that as an excuse to let people out on bail when they shouldn't be let out on bail. Take care of your own backyard, and I think you'll get meaningful change.
Okay, yeah, takes time. I think that whole flight about live streaming bail hearings came as he was announcing, you know, building more jail space. But the other thing is, again, you know, one of our callers mentioned the statues. So, you know, I'm a believer in that broken window theory. And if you start with smaller things, so instead of charging protesters who vandalize public property, we are covering up the statues. And I remember, do you remember this attack by academics on Heather Reisman's Indigo?
And they
sprayed paint, and people were actually charged, and there was this outrage. But we have the right to deface her property because we don't agree with her. I mean, it's so pervasive. I don't know how you deal with it, Karen.
Well, there is no question that we've lost the plot on this one, and that, you know, it started with some revisionist history and forgetting of our history and rewriting of our history, you know, and suddenly our national heroes became shameful. And that was, and we let that happen. I mean, we watched it happen and we allowed it to happen. And so I think there does need to be an intentional effort to take back some of the history, and to, because if we don't understand our history, we're subject to the failures recurring again. So we owe it to ourselves and to those who, you know, and to those who were part of that history to remember it the way it should have been remembered. And so, yes, I think it is shameful that we've allowed, you know, politics to into our public spaces, and we've forgotten that our history needs to be protected, and it's all of our obligation to be loud and to be, again, intentional about remembering that.
Yeah, but whether you agree with the history or not, like, you can't spray
the
paint
history
at it.
Right? It doesn't change. Like, right. It doesn't change what happened. And right. So, like, again, like, you know, you can deface a statue. It doesn't change history. It just means that you've defaced public property. And so,
well, exactly.
I don't understand why we've conceded that. We've conceded our public spaces. We've conceded our statues and our memorials and our history. Like, I don't know how to reclaim it, but it has to be done at the political level.
And I think Karen's point is a good one there. You know, if the solution is we're going to box these things up because we know there's going to be a protest and we know people are likely to deface it, isn't the answer actually to enforce the laws that are on the books? Why are we proactively, you know, covering these things up, anticipating people breaking the law, rather than putting the resources in place in the theater to actually prevent people from breaking the law? Or if, in fact, when they do, they are charged and dealt with through the criminal process appropriately. John, like, that's what we ought to be doing.
Yeah, and Brad's right. But, like, when we're talking about history, I think, respectfully, on this subject, we're kind of missing the point. On the weekend, there's going to be a protest about OSAP cuts, and they expect vandalism. So I don't think that has to do with, you know, history per se. It's vandalism, plain and simple. People taking out their anger and vandalizing public property. And the problem is, as politicians, we often make excuses for that behavior. And when I heard Merritt Stiles saying, well, the best way to avoid this is by not, you know, cutting OSAP. No.
Exactly. Right? That's appalling.
Yeah, that to me is the issue, is when we as, you know, leaders in whatever capacity that might be, is that we start making excuses. You have to separate the two. You can protest, you can be angry, and you might have a very good point. That does not give you license to start defacing public property. End stop.
And let's do something about it. I mean, I used to study history, and the fact is, it's reassessed and reevaluated all the time. Fine. But again, you know, whatever you think about it, you shouldn't be defacing statues because now you think that Sir John A. was a bad guy or Egerton Ryerson, whatever. Like, it is not an excuse. And again, some of the things that some people on the left keep saying, it's, we have to fix the problems of society. It's our fault that somebody is doing this because they're not getting enough money from the government, which is ridiculous.
And to come full circle on it, the idea that spray painting or tipping over a statue, a bronze statue in Queen's Park, is somehow going to increase funding for post-secondary is obviously disconnected, disjointed, and a bit ludicrous. So when people engage in vandalism, they ought to be charged. Us taking proactive measures to put them in plywood boxes and stuff because we're anticipating people are going to do this, I just think, you know, it's probably more strategic to have resources on the ground in play to prevent people from doing them or charging them appropriately when they break the law.
Well, yeah. And I'm wondering, does anybody know how much we're going to spend to box them up and get all of that done? No.
I don't know, but I just drove past Queen Park Circle and I saw them out there with the barricades and the trailers and, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 people working on it. So they're doing it right now.
Okay. 10 or 15 people working on it. And we know the price of lumber is up. I'm going to take one call. I know we're over time on this segment, but I want to hear from Gord in Sarnia quickly. Hi, Gord.
Hi, Libby. Just very quickly, you know, there's a big picture issue here, and that is that our society has reached a point where there is no consequences for negative behavior, whether that be vandalism, home invasion, or right up to murder. My brother is a retired police officer, and he said they used to arrest people, put them in the back of the police car, and they would joke, and, you know, through the screen, they'd say to the cop, you know what, we'll be out before you're finished the paperwork on this call. And it's true. I think that we need to do a number of things. We need to take a look at the big picture. The feds need to rewrite the Young Offenders Act so there's some consequences. We need some judge accountability. Right now in the province of Ontario, actually, it's against the law to criticize a judge or their judgment, and that needs to change. They need to be held accountable.
Gordon, all very interesting thoughts, but we're out of time, Gordon, and if you want to come back and tell us a little more about what's on your mind, Free for All Friday is coming up tomorrow, but thank you so much for your call, and thank you, John Burnside, Karen Stintz, and Brad Bradford, and we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, we're taking another break, and boy, from things that are making us unhappy here, what makes us happy? The 2026 Global Happiness Index is out, and I'm afraid that the results for Canada will not make us so happy, but we'll talk about it.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. So how happy are you? How happy are we as a nation? And yes, that is something that is measured every year with the Global Happiness Index. And I'm afraid that this year's results will not make Canadians happy. We ranked 25th out of 147 countries when just a decade ago, we were up there at number 6, just behind the Scandinavians, who very counterintuitively are the happiest people in the world. So why do we have this malaise when the fact is that whatever our problems, we still live in one of the most prosperous and stable countries in the world. And while we're on that subject, people who live in countries with a lot worse external circumstances, like Israel, where bombs and drones are hitting them every day, well, they are a lot higher than us. They're, I think, number six. So that's a big question. Why? And the people who put this list together put a lot of it on economic circumstances, on social programs, which we know the Scandinavians have, you know, really good ones. I beg to differ a bit. I think a lot of it has to do with the feeling of belonging to a community. And I think a lot of it also has to do with whether you compare yourself to people who have more than you. So let me give the numbers out again. I'd like to hear what our audience thinks. 866-744-740, that's our text line and our long distance phone line, and also 416-360-0740. And now I am joined by Lord Richard Laird, a professor at the Center for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics, David Valentin, who is a principal at Liaison Strategies, and Steve Jordans, a professor of psychology at the U of T. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
Is Lord Richard Laird, are you unmuted? I think he's muted. Okay. No. We will try to get in touch.
Okay, I'm here now.
Oh,
I'm
good. There. You're here now. So what are your thoughts on having an index like this? What is it really measuring?
Well, as you can, does measure how satisfied people are with their lives. And that is ultimately the thing that really matters. And of course, it's caused by all kinds of things. In this particular issue this year, we focused on the role of the social media. And of course, that particularly comes to the fore when you're talking about young people, and the particularly big drop that's happened in the well-being measurement for young people in all the English-speaking countries. That's really fallen over the last 10 years. And of course, that coincides with the increase in the use of social media. And there's quite a lot of supporting evidence that social media are causing a part of this drop that you started talking about at the beginning. People who use social media a lot are less happy than people who use it a little. And here's an extraordinary survey which was done in the US of students. They were asked, why are you using social media? Answer, because other people are. Would you prefer that there were no social media? Yes, people would feel happier if there were no social media. But of course, they have to use social media if everybody else is using it. So I think this is for young people, which is a big part of the average you quoted, a very big bit of the story at the moment in English-speaking countries.
Yep. I just to parse those numbers a little bit, Canada ranks 25th, but if you just look at younger people, among the younger people, we dropped to 71 or something. And Steve Jordans, yes, social media is a big part of it. And a big part of social media is trying to make your life look rosy and people comparing themselves to you. And an adjacent question, I mean, social media has been banned in Australia for people under 16. But most people you ask here saying, can you do that? They say, oh, no, we couldn't do that.
Yeah, well, we should consider it. You know, largely like Richard has been saying here, it's not just social media. It's the asynchronous communication that comes with it, you know, doing everything not face-to-face. And I want to get back to what you mentioned, community, belonging. We form those trusting relationships. They are the number one predictor of happiness. How do you have three or four people in your life that you can really count on, that really are there for you and that you are there for? People who have that are the happy people. People who don't, less so. And young people nowadays are not engaging in a lot of face-to-face. They're having trouble forming those trust-based relationships. They have much shallower relationships based on emojis and texts instead of real shared emotional experiences. And as a result, we're seeing happiness decline. It's not horrible to be the 25th happiest person in a room of 147. But when we talk about the number you just talked about, where the youth are more around 71, well, you know, that's, I think, cause for concern.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're starting to see, you know, little sort of pop-ups of people getting together in the real world. But David, and you are the youngest person on this panel, but people are so wary. They want real world and face-to-face contact, but you know, half the time they make plans with people and they cancel them, and they're relieved when they cancel them. So it just seems to be this, you know, great ball of anxiety.
Yeah, and let me just briefly touch upon the good news, which is that for Canadians over the age of 60, if you were just to look at those scores, the scores are much higher. Right, Canada's in the top 10 for happiness for people over the age of 60. So there's some good news there, just briefly. But look, you're right about this. And the social anxiety that comes from not just doing face-to-face communication, but talking to people on the telephone. You know, in some of the industry work that we're doing, you know, young workers want to resolve everything by text and email. Even getting on a phone can bring sort of this social anxiety, which is weird to me because, you know, in my business, which we all do a lot of phone work, but also, you know, it sort of contributes to a whole bunch of other factors. When we're doing social research as polling firms and we're using live agent phone calls, you know, we've always had a difficulty reaching people 18 to 34, particularly males. It's getting harder and harder because they don't like talking on the phone. And so this idea that you're going to talk to them, not even just for a conversation, but for an actual questionnaire, which the government uses to collect information for the census, employment statistics, CPI, all these different metrics, it's getting harder and harder to get those respondents. So this has a lot of different effects on the social anxiety, has a lot of different effects on not just the economy, but also the way we gather the data, the way we're able to interpret it. And I think that has far-reaching consequences.
Absolutely. I was glad you said they're still okay with email. I thought email was only becoming the purview for old people. And it had to be just text. I'm going to take a call from Michalina in Newmarket. Hi, Michalina.
Hi. I agree with your community's paramount subject. I totally agree. I was self-employed and part of a very vital downtown community until I fell, had an accident, broke my neck, and was thrust into the Ontario Disabled Socially Assisted Community, which is demoralized and marginalized at every turn. But to separate yourself from even that pit of despair is detrimental, because I believe there's still humanity to be found in a breadline than alone in a one room in the basement, over surveilled, packed, overpriced room.
Okay. So, Michalina, I hope that you get back to your community. And I can hear their lack of opportunities and also some difficulties physically. So, it is a complicated thing, Lord Laird.
Yeah, of course, we're talking about the findings of the World Happiness Report. And one of the striking things is that the main problem areas seem to be in the English-speaking countries. So young people have not become less happy in most of the rest of the world, and they are using social media just as much. So it's something to do with the way that the social media are operating with people in the English-speaking world. These algorithmic feeds, the influences, the huge effort to keep people online. Negativity is obviously going to be a very good way of keeping people online, to give them sensational negative emotions. So that's the kind of stuff which is so often fed. So you've got the negative experience when you're online, and as we've been saying earlier on, you're missing out on the positive experience you could have in the interaction with other people. So I think it's these Western and especially English-speaking countries that are most at risk. And I think this is ultimately linked to this very individualistic culture, competitive culture, where people are all the time comparing themselves with other people. It's so striking that in the World Happiness Report, the top countries are all the Scandinavian countries, in which there is much more emphasis from childhood upwards on what you have in common, what people have in common, what they share, and not in showing how different and better they are than other people.
Is that, if we are to take a page and emulate what's different in those countries and the way they use social media, is that kind of the main thing? Is there something, I guess, more tangible that we could latch onto?
So if I may jump in here, I had an interesting conversation with somebody who had just come to Canada from Egypt, a young person. And his reflection on Canada was, it doesn't have the third spaces. And I said, what do you mean by the third space? He said, well, you got your workspace, you got your home space. But in Egypt, when you lack anything else to do, you go down to the streets, and the streets are the third space, and everybody's out there, and you meet your friends, you meet new people, and they're all socializing real time. We don't have a lot of that in Canada. We don't really, you think of Europe, you think of the piazzas and the beautiful, where they all go out to dinners regularly and spend some time and prioritize face-to-face social interactions. We need to, like, if I was talking to parents now, I would say, put your children into sports or the arts or a job somewhere where they're going to be interacting with other humans in real time, trying to accomplish something. Don't let them sit in their room playing video games all day. They're just not developing those social skills that you really need to form the connections that's going to give you happiness. And so I think, it's not so much about they're using social media, but what they're not doing. And if I was counseling a parent, I would say, make that social media contingent on, having these other interactions first. I'm part of a group that released the first ever Canadian social connection guidelines. You can find them online. Jen Well is behind this. And it really is to give us all an idea of things we could be doing to enhance our children's and each other's ability to socially connect and find happiness through social connection.
Well, sports are a good idea. I mean, I think our streets are alive when the weather's better, but who wants to go out in the kind of winter that will just not let go? I mean, it honestly,
Even then, though, when I was a youth, there were kids out playing ball hockey on the streets. There were much more kids outside doing stuff together than you will see now if you drive around a subdivision. Way more kids are in their bedroom alone.
And is part of that, David, I mean, we just had a conversation with our municipal panel about people not feeling safe. I mean, there was a point, I don't know if it was in the 80s or the 90s. I mean, when I was a kid, you just went out to play and you could do that for a long time. But there was a point where people stopped allowing their kids to do that, David.
Well, I mean, listen, this goes on to trends about perceptions of crime, and sometimes people perceive crime as higher than what it actually is, which leads to an interesting dichotomy where maybe you don't want your kids to be out there even though there's no real risk in your particular subdivision. But one interesting thing that we've been finding in our research is we've looked at post-anxiety, but also how long does it take for you to consider or make an Instagram post? And it's an interesting situation where you would think the younger someone is, the more familiar they are with Instagram, the faster they would be to be able to get a post up there, whether it's a photo or a video or something of the sort. But the research actually tells us the opposite. The older you are, the faster you will make the post. the younger you are, the more you are going to overthink this thing and ask yourself, do I have the right filter? Do I have the right emojis? Do I have the right caption? Do I have the right carousel order? If some of these terms don't make a lot of sense to you, it's all the different ways you can modify your Instagram post if you're posting on that platform. Is it a post or is it a story? Who do you tag? Who do you not tag? The younger you are, the more time you spend obsessing about this. And so something that could take a minute, I mean, when I was in university, an Instagram post would take me a minute to do. I figure out a caption, I take my photo, that's about it. Now it can take up to an hour, sometimes more than an hour for some of these young people who are creating these really hyper-curated versions of their life. And you know, you're not out playing in the street when you are in your bedroom figuring out, am I using the right filter? Should I Photoshop this pimple in or out? Because, you know, sometimes you don't want it to look like you have makeup on. There's all these different concerns. And that also creates a whole lot of anxiety.
Oh, God, I have watched a lot of makeup tutorials. And believe me, they look like they're wearing piles of makeup.
Yeah.
I wish we could continue the conversation, but we're really out of time. Maybe we'll have to revisit it. And thank you so much for that, especially Lord Richard Layard in London. Thanks for joining us all the way from there. And thank you also to Steve Jordan's, a psychologist, and David Valentin, who is a pollster, a lot of insight on this. And, you know, maybe we need to kind of push back on this stuff and figure out how to get past it. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. We're taking another break. And when we come back, do you know what maple washing is? It is not sweet. And it is, something that involves lives and fines, and we'll talk about it when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, do you still pay attention to the amount of Canadian content in your groceries? Well, many of us try to still, even though I think that trend has waned a bit. And unfortunately, some grocers take advantage of that by lying about it. Well, this week, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency announced that since last spring, when this really was a thing, it has imposed $47,000 worth of fines on five businesses for misleading or inaccurate country of origin claims. And that includes two $10,000 fines on stores owned by Loblaw. Now, instead of contrition, one of the industry associations has pushed back on this, saying that these fines for false made in Canada claims could chill investment, make people pull back from actually finding Canadian products. So what do you think of that? Again, text 866-744-740, also long-distance phone lines. I'm looking at the time, so let's get to our guest, Maria Corradini, who is professor and Arl Chair in Food Quality in the Department of Food Science at the University of Guelph. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me, Libby.
Okay, so what do you think about A, the fines, and B, pushing back, saying, oh, don't put fines on people for lying?
Well, as you well said, any kind of misrepresentation of the food supply, of course, that it comes with a harm to the reputation of the food industry. So I think that putting fines on any misclaim or misrepresentation is needed. Of course, that it goes beyond just lying about source of origin. That puts in the consumer a question about other claims that the product carry. So I think that is needed, and it should be enforced, because any misrepresentation actually harms the reputation of the food industry.
But let's get to this. I mean, I think that this whole thing has eased a bit. But I remember back a year ago when it started, people were really adamant, even if it hurt their choices, you know, we're not buying products that come from the United States. You know, does the fact that there were fines, I think, may have bolstered that, no?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I think that the fines are needed because any kind of doubt that the public has about the sources that they are or the quality or the safety of the food that they are buying usually comes back to hurt them. I don't think that the fine, I think that the trade block, yeah, of course, that harms the food industry in general. And we have sort of conducted a survey that actually showed that the trade agreements and the inhibition or the installment of those trade agreements actually force or let people to do alternative choices. I think that that was probably the main driver rather than the fines. The fines actually are a response to a misbehavior.
And do people have faith in their grocery stores? Do they think that they're being misled? I know that, you know, there are always these studies on whether the grocery stores are gouging us, and we keep hearing profit margins are so small, but people just don't quite buy it.
Well, the margins are small, that's for sure. However, depending on the store, there is some level of mistrust, and by this kind of behavior and even that outrageous response, in my opinion, of course, that emphasizes the mistrust that people might have into particular retailers. I think that the food industry in Canada is very strong, is very safe, and very reliable, and people know that. So we have a good supply of food consistently, and the quality of the products is amazing. But, you know, some misbehavior, of course, that has to be put into some oversight. There has to be some overseeing of their behavior in order to undermine this reputation.
Okay. Maria Corradini, thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow, so we can talk about whatever you want to talk about. I'll be back here and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.